This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
On last week's show, we aired 25 minutes of a conversation I had with legendary reporter Seymour Hersh. I promised that we'd also release a longer version, and here it is. Cy Hersh is famous for consequential scoops, from exposing the massacre of Vietnamese civilians in My Lai, to CIA surveillance, to the torture of Iraqis in Abu Ghraib. Most recently, he's the author of Reporter, a memoir. He's also a twin. And once when asked by the parents of twins what it's like to be one, he replied, "It's great. I won."
I have twin sisters, too. He's a physicist from UC, California, but he's got a specialty in wave theory. Mm-hmm. And here's a story about America. There was a program called, you got a second?
Sure.
Deep Sea Submergence Program. It was run out of Hawaii undercover. It was one of the biggest secret programs in the government. A guy named John Craven would get people who knew wave theory, noise underwater, my brother's expertise, and monitor Russian submarines. So a new submarine would come out, and we'd pick up the sound of the engine, and there were people that would translate this to know where every Russian submarine, particularly the boomers, the one with nuclear weapons, were at any time. My brother was brought into that program to help him. And in the 70s, when he got in, I was writing about the program and exposing all the stupid things they were doing. And he said, about 1990 or so, you know, he said, I was in a very secret program.
And you didn't know your brother was in it?
No, he didn't tell me because it was very top secret. He said, you have no idea the trouble you caused me. Every year I had to take a lie detector test. When it was all over, the guy said to me, you know, your brother's a real asshole. And I thought to myself, what a nice story about America.
It is.
They didn't ever suspect him of talking to me.
As you describe in the memoir, he was the one who was allowed to go off and pursue the sciences until he graduated. You were going to take care of your mom. Your father had died, took over your father's dry cleaning business. Then you worked in a liquor store. You did a bit of flailing around. But there was an intervention.
What happened was, back in the 1950s, in high school, in my third year, my father got cancer. My father had a business, a ghetto business, laundry and cleaning, a small shop that kept the family going. My parents were both Eastern European, didn't talk much. There was not much communication, so I was self-taught. I used to buy the Book of the Month Club, nonfiction, every month. Half the time it was J. Edgar Hoover warning about communism, but a lot of times it was about the Habsburg monarchy and Chinese civilization, so I used to read this stuff. I had some test that I took in the beginning of my fourth year, and there were three of us who did well, and one went to Harvard. I think they both ended up there, and I went nowhere. I barely could graduate. I was just running my father's business and being horribly depressed. My father was dying. Mm-hmm. And so there's a local two-year junior college in Chicago that was run by the University of Illinois. It didn't exist till after the war. Guys came back from the war, and they were working, and they wanted to be educated, but they couldn't afford to go to the main campus in Champaign or Urbana, 150 miles away. So they set up a two-year program, a junior college, in an old Navy barracks that they had built into Lake Michigan. I went to school there. And I go to this class, and I wrote a paper. And the guy who was teaching had just gotten his doctorate at Chicago, turned in the paper, and a week later, at the end of the class, he said, "Is Seymour Hersh here?" So I walked up thinking, like, 99% of the kids in the world, what had I done wrong? And he said, "What are you doing here?" I began to mumble something. My father got sick, blah, blah, blah. And I was 18. Mm-hmm. He said, "Meet me at the University of Chicago admissions office in 2 days. And I did. And the next thing I know, I'm going to this wonderful university. What makes it, to me, very emotional is I forgot all that. I go on with life.
You get to be a big deal.
I get to be a big deal. 1983, I write a book about Kissinger. and my wife was going through mail, and she opened this letter. It was from the professor. And it began by saying, "You probably don't remember me, but I've intervened twice in all my years of teaching, and one of them became a neurosurgeon, and the other one was you." And I began to cry, because I suddenly remembered that moment. What are you doing here? And it happened again and again in my career. People saw things in me early on that I didn't think I had.
And your first stop in journalism, City News, the place that you say Ben Hecht based the front page on?
Right.
You said you were smitten, but you observed that, and I quote you, "the ambitious young reporters working the courthouses and the police beats understood their mission was to live within the system and somehow make the city work." That's awful.
It was tyranny. It was a police and mob tyranny. I came there as a copy boy, but I was clearly smart and interesting to some of the editors. I was a little mouthy too, but so what? They got me to the street. I got into central police, and you have to understand, I'm suddenly free. I suddenly am not running this dinky store that was crazy. You know, I was on my own. I could actually do something. This job saved me. I fell into it. But after being a cop reporter for about 3 or 4 months, there was a killing in the middle of the night. And two cops radioed in that somebody tried to escape and they had to shoot him. And I was in Central Police overnight. Most of the time it was quiet and we smoked the dope the cops had. But sometimes you had a lot of action. And there was a killing. A cop had shot somebody. So I wanted to see the guys when they drove in to the parking lot. And so I get down and just as these two beefy, red, typical Chicago cops pull in. And one of their other buddies says, "Hey, Mick, so that guy tried to escape and you had to shoot him." He said, "Nah," he said, "I told the nigga to run and I shot him. I heard it." And so I call my editor. "I can't believe what I just heard. And I've got the license number." He said, "Don't touch it." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "It's your word against theirs. You're going to have to be off that beat if you do that. And you may have to leave the reporting business." So I went a couple of days later and I looked up the coroner's report. Sure enough, 3 bullets in the back. And I tried again to go pursue the story. The editor said, "You don't understand. You're not going to do that story."
What lesson did you take from that?
Oh, a big lesson. That the business I adored so much was full of self-censorship and compromise, and so was I. Because I went off to join the Army right a few weeks later and never pushed it again. That we aren't perfect. And I maybe hate self-censorship. And I think that was one of the lessons I endured. I mean, there were other things I learned being a police reporter. You know, you've got, you know, to get along. I also learned to respect people in jobs you don't think are very smart. You know, a lot of the desk sergeants in Chicago in the 1950s were third-generation cops, and they had no choice. And there was a guy up north who could take the New York Times Sunday Puzzle and with a pencil go through it and then did the London Times acrostic, like that, just boom, boom, boom. I mean, who knows how bright he was, but he was stuck in a job. So I learned to not make value judgments about people. And
another lesson you learned that you mentioned several times in your book is read before you write.
Oh, my God.
Explain that and how that lesson got driven home.
Well, I eventually made my way. I got to be after the Army, I worked on a suburban newspaper, and I got a job at United Press. And even there, I was covering the state legislation in a place called Pierce, South Dakota. And that's great because, you know, I'm just this kid from this Chicago, big city kid, and it was good just to be there and to get along and learn. Anyway, and I did things like they mistreated the Indians there. And South Dakota had an incredible Indian culture. You know, most of the great chiefs of the 19th century came, Ogallala Sioux. So I wrote about the abuses of the Indians. And in a funny way, the stories I wrote locally for the UPI ended up in the Chicago Tribune, which helped me get a job in Chicago later that I didn't know. But more than that, you had to read. You had to learn about budgets.
Mm-hmm.
Had to just go beyond the day-to-day stuff. And so
the history of the Native Americans that
and
you
the history of the legislature,
mm-hmm.
because I was working covering a legislature, so I get to the AP from there, and I was by this time at 63, and I'm into the war. I'm reading the New York Times. I'm passionate for the war. I'm not a war lover, but I'm just reading Homer Bigard and Dave Halberstam and Neil Sheehan.
You're passionate about the coverage, about the project of the war.
No, but I'm passionate about the fact that these guys were That time, the critical policy, it wasn't about, they thought communism was bad, but they also thought we were fighting the war the wrong way. And that's where I was sort of at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd gone to the University of Chicago where we worried about Ike and the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was the 50s and it was a quiet time. And in comparison, you know, you had just this, there was, you know, the Korean War had yet, you know, was over, and it was a quiet, so there was a ban the bomb movement, but that was seemed far away to me. But somehow getting to, I covered civil rights, I covered Martin Luther King, I was a good reporter. I mean, I was a good writer. And so the AP was wonderful. After 6 months or 7 months in Chicago, my job was to go write a story a day. And then they sent me to Washington, where they were also very nice to me, and sent me to the Pentagon, a very major beat. And so at the Pentagon, I was steeped in the war. And here's what I learned about the military very early. I was also in the military, and there were a lot of very good guys. And what you're looking for are those guys who signed the oath of office. It's to the Constitution. It's not to the president. It's not to some general they work for. If you find those guys, and I would look for them. And so I began to read not only about, I began to talk to them about what was going on in Vietnam, and OJT, on-the-job training. They would, after trusting, learning to trust me, because I am trustworthy, and they would like me and trust me, and they would tell me what a bloodbath it was and how awful it was and how counterproductive it was. So I began to read then the church stuff. The church, various Protestant groups were putting out clergy reports on the war. And also I read a lot of Bertrand Russell's tribunal that everybody made poo-poo about because Bertrand Russell was old and crazy left-winger.
Mm-hmm.
His tribunal had a section on Vietnam where they had four guys who served in Vietnam telling about they would go into a village looking for the bad boys, the Viet Cong, and of course they wouldn't be there and they'd all be frustrated. And in one case, one guy who I found, he was back in Cleveland, he confirmed what he said anyway. In one case, the officer would say, okay, I'm really mad. Everybody in the tank, take your guns and just, you have a mad minute to shoot up everybody in the hooches. Just a mad minute. So,
where did you hear this?
I heard this. I read it in the pen. It was in the Bertrand Russell Tribunal.
Uh-huh.
And
mm-hmm.
The kid who did it, one of them was from, and no coverage of that. One of them, a kid that went home, one of them went home and the local AP did a local story about him that I could track down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was bad stuff. And so when 2 years later, I get a tip about My Lai.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think was, oh my God, these guys, I was told, just a wonderful man named Jeff Cohen, whose father was the Cohn that ran, Lou Cohn, who was head of ABC, CBS News. So Jeff was, he'd come out of Yale Law School. Oh my God, I didn't turn this off.
Oh no, it's your phone.
Let me just, here, just, let's just.
You were talking about got the tip about My Lai and skip over.
Okay. It came from Jeffrey Cohn, whose father had been president of CBS News and had an interest in news. And he had learned from somebody. He was a lawyer. He got out of Yale Law School and he was working for one of the first law firms that did public interest law, a novel thing back in 69. And he learned from a friend, I know who, but we've agreed we're not going to talk about it, somebody
mm-hmm.
who had firsthand information. There was a terrible incident in Vietnam. Somebody had shot up, killed at least 75 people. Some soldier had gone crazy. That's what I learned. And so I was writing a book then. I was freelancing. I was writing a book for Random House on the Pentagon and about its power and its waste of money, et cetera. And of course, it was boring. And so, but there was something in me that said, this is it. You know, this is consistent with what I learned from GI, the soldiers I talked to, not only GIs, but officers, majors, lieutenant colonels, nobody above that, who would talk to me how bad the war was. And there were a few senior generals who would, you know, hear me go on and on about the war and say, I'm not going to talk about it. You know, I would vent about it sometimes. Anyway, I wasn't casual about a bad war. It didn't seem to me. I didn't think I was a lefty thinking the war was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I was learning that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ask my dentist whether he's a righty or a lefty. I just want to be sure he's pretty good at what he does. And I think journalism, that's the standard we should have.
Mm-hmm.
We should be entitled to have opinions, but just, and as long as we're writing absolutely professionally, which a lot of people do. I remember having a big fight with Len Donahue.
Hold on just a moment. Let's stick with My Lai for
okay.
a moment.
Right,
we've previously discussed My Lai at length, and we'll link to that interview again. But you told us that when you went after that story, which was about the massacre by U.S. troops of every last man, woman, and child in a North Vietnamese village. In this case, how much were you pushed for? How much were you pushed by a thirst for justice, and how much by hunger for a blockbuster scoop? Because you describe how you didn't want to give it to the Times, but at least you didn't want them to steal it from you. I mean, this represented more than just the pointlessness of the war and the loss of the war and.
But you also have to understand something. This is a memoir.
Right.
And you know, when I wrote my first book about My Lai, my editor was a wonderful man named Robert Loomis at Random House, and we said, how much should we get into my reporting? And he said, nobody cares that much. Do it in the page. This is before All the President's Men, mm-hmm. which changed everything. In this case, of course, I didn't know what it was. I knew there was something there. I was bored also with the book I was doing, and I started chasing it. And I didn't get far, but what was I thinking of? Yes, I was thinking of that this would be a story that could change the war, but I always thought it was about a terrible mad minute. I always thought it was about an American bomb that went wrong and killed the whole village. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I did not, and I'm talking now in terms of myself, I didn't know what I was getting into until I began to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
When I began to get, there was a young man named Rod Ridenour. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know how bad it was. We were talking about GIs going into a village of 500 people or more, no, thinking there might be an enemy there. To their credit, they went there. If there was an enemy, they were ready to fight. Seeing no enemy, just going and killing everybody, thinking that's the orders, throwing babies in the air and catching them on bayonets.
Which happened a few days after My Lai. You mentioned Ridenour. He was formerly a soldier. He'd flown
yes.
over the area that was My Lai?
He'd flown over the area while still on active duty. He had a year in Vietnam. He'd flown over and he'd seen about a week after the My Lai. My Lai took place on March 16th, 1968, March 16th. And he flew over in late March and he said, what's going on? And the pilot said, because guys knew everything, pilots see everything, of a helicopter, said, oh, a bunch of guys went crazy and killed everybody. So he found out what unit it was, and he was in a... an elite unit that did the advanced patrol, so he would have time off. He was risking his life every minute patrolling in Laos and et cetera. A very gutsy guy, Ron Ridenour, very decent. Well, he died young of a heart attack years ago. I adored him. Anyway, the point is that he began asking, found out the unit, it was William Cowley's unit, began asking people, but he took no notes. He was afraid to take notes. What he was learning was so terrible. So he went back home. He got out of the army in late 68. And this was in March 68 it took place, and began writing letters to people, did some more work on it. In the spring of 69, he wrote letters to 40 or 50 people. Only a few responded. And by the time I got into My Lai, as far as he was concerned, the Army hadn't done anything to say, we're looking into it, but don't talk.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is I got into it, I found Cowley, I did the story. The numbers killed 111. I still thought that could be consistent with just a mad minute. You know, I didn't realize how grotesque it was, and so Ridenour then gave an interview about what he did that was connected into a Washington Post story. I did a story in the middle of the week in November, I think, or October, the first Cowley story that a lot of papers did buy. But we were stuck after that. I didn't know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pentagon said nothing, and the networks didn't touch it in time. And I thought we were stuck. Nobody picked up on it. And there was no bounce to it. And then the Washington Post that Sunday did a story saying, guess what? That stories like this occur because American troops often get in position where they don't know who the enemy is. And sometimes the only thing they do to protect themselves is they get more aggressive with shooting. And that's how these kind of incidents can take place. The exact opposite of what I understood took place.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the bottom,
how did you understand it? You understood it as just a kind of insanity.
I understood there was a mad moment, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that it took 5 hours and they had, during the break, during the killing, as we all know, they stopped and ate their lunch by the ditch in which they'd shot people. None of that was known to me.
Yeah.
And
so this
anyway,
wasn't defensive. This was evil.
I didn't know the extent to which it wasn't just the way people fight wars, this horrible way we fight wars. And I it was hard to get your head around what happened. I mean, even as I learned more and more, I would be, whatever thrill I had, of course, the thought I had when I began to get close to the story and found Callie and found his lawyer, of course, I had two muddled thoughts. One was fame, fortune, and glory.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is, this is going to, you know, this, God, maybe we can do something to stop this war. I was so frustrated as a reporter in late 67 after my experiences in the CIA that I actually went, my neighbor was Mary McGrory, a wonderful columnist who was also against the war, and Bobby Kennedy wouldn't run, but a senator named McCarthy would, and Mary convinced me to go work for him.
That is a fascinating chapter, because this guy was a real SOB.
He was, as his daughter once said to me, Marion, who was wonderful, his oldest daughter, I used to ask in the morning how he is. You never knew how he would be. And she said, oh, alienated as usual. He was very difficult.
You suggest that one reason why he was so resistant to you when you were hired as press secretary for his campaign and resistant to all the volunteers who had given so much of their time and their effort to get him on the ballot was that really all they cared about was the war. They didn't really care about him as a candidate. It just seems so vain and a distinction without a difference fundamentally.
You know, it was very upsetting to me that I would say this, particularly after we did so well in New Hampshire, but even before that, if you remember, the thing was get clean for Gene. And so in order to work for the McCarthy campaign, you had to shave off your hair, cut your hair, shave off your beard and cut your hair. You could have and we had
no ponytails,
and thousands of kids responded. We had tremendous outpouring and you knew, we didn't know that we were going to make Johnson leave, but we did. We got 42% of a write-in vote and Johnson got 45%. Actually
in New Hampshire.
Yeah. And that Johnson quit. He knew it was over. And then Bobby came in. But McCarthy was sour about that. We all knew Bobby would come in at the right time. I've always been a little bitter about Bobby ever since, even though I concede he was a different Bobby in 68 than he was in 63.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
mm-hmm.
But anyway, the bottom line is that, yes, he was a very devout Catholic. He'd been in a monastery for 9 months. Silence, and I couldn't write about that. I was his press secretary.
Oh, it was silence? It was the...
it was a mm-hmm. monastery. It was a Benedictine monastery, mm-hmm. and he didn't talk in those monasteries. At least that was the rule. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm sure, obviously, there was some talking, but basically the rule was silence. You met and ate in silence. He was very religious. He went to the Mass every day. I could never talk about that because he was very good on keeping him separate. And so, I went to interview him, and he couldn't care less about a press secretary. So I said to Mary McGrory, are you nuts? I can't work for this guy. I'd worked with senators. I worked with good senators as a journalist, and most of them care about the press. He didn't. But it was fascinating because I then went, they said, spend a day, and I went and listened to him give a speech in New York. And it was amazing. He was very brilliant. And he spoke about what the Constitution said, and he just said something I'd never heard anybody say in public life, then or now. He said the war was immoral.
Mm-hmm.
And that came from his Catholic background. And I fell in love then. I don't care how diffident he was how impossible to deal with. He used to always scream at me because the press liked me. And he said, you have them sleeping in my car, sleeping in my bed. They all love you, but they're supposed to love me. But that's the way it is with senators. They're, you know.
Well, but ultimately, what pushed you off the campaign?
Oh, politics, horrible politics. You know, in the beginning, it was wonderful. What pushed me off was, we had done well in New Hampshire, and Bobby was in, and we went to Wisconsin, and we were going to do well in Wisconsin. And then there were a couple, there was somebody I wanted very much to run the campaign, and he didn't get the job. And the people who did were very political. I wasn't political. I was just against the war, and so were the kids working for me. And it was amazing. You know, I did travel with Robert Lowell and Paul Newman mm-hmm. and people like that. It was a great time in a way. There was a great commitment about the war. McCarthy had it too, but he didn't think that the kids were there for him. He thought they were there for the war. I couldn't shake him of that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a poll done in Madison. We were in Milwaukee, and there was a poll done that showed he would win 62% of the vote if he stayed away from the black community. He was supposed to have a march in the Milwaukee black community. But as you know, Wisconsin's full of a lot of ethnic people, Polish in particular, Ukrainians, who were, you know, not hostile to blacks, I could say. I think that's a fair thing to say in general. It's a stupid generality, but it's true. The polling showed if he stayed away from marching in the black community, he'd win 58%. If he did the he'd win 62%. If he did the march, he did 58. And so I was just back from a day, you know, whatever you do when you're, I was working on a speech for the next day. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of speech writing too. And I liked McCarthy. He liked me up to a point. I learned that they were gonna cancel the parade in the Black Ghetto the next day in Milwaukee. And I went nuts. I ran running in. And so I woke up McCarthy. It was about 6 in the morning. I didn't care. Everybody was mad at me for doing it. I woke him up. Went into his room and bedroom and said, "Get up," you know. And he was irritated. Now, who wouldn't be? And I said, "Is it so that we're not going to campaign?" He said, "It's none of your business."
Wow.
I said, "Sir, you understand what you're doing." He said, "That's not your department." And so I went and quit.
Mm.
That was it. I mean, I waited a day and I left. I mean, I couldn't work for somebody who did that. I was tired anyway. It's a terrible job, politics.
Mm.
I never liked politics anyway. And there were people seriously talking about what job they're going to get in the government. Who are they kidding? Bobby Kennedy was going to win if he lived. Maybe not, but I always thought so.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the long and short of it is I learned a lot about politics from that. And one day, actually, I will tell you, it's in the memoir. I'm not telling any stories out of school, but there were guys hanging around, fellow Catholic buddies of Gene, I thought, who were raising money for him and who his buddies, you know, they were all. Later, one of them I learned from a neighbor friend of mine had been the chief of station in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very decent guy. Tom McCoy was his name. I'm not giving you any name.
Yeah,
that
he had CIA friends, McCarthy did. That's not necessarily a terrible thing.
No, because McCarthy was from the DFL, the Democratic, you know, the party. It was from a party in Minnesota that was very conservative politically and anti-communist. Hubert Humphrey is a classic example, but also very liberal on social issues. So he was all right. So I said to him, "Tell me about it." So he told me a lot about the CIA, and he told me also I met people who later helped me, because there's an element always in all these organizations. Again, all I can say is there's people in the CAA who believe in the truth, and there are people who don't. And there's a lot of good people. So I was lucky in the way I got to a lot of people who believed in the truth. And when they saw somebody in me who was smart enough to read and know what's going on, people often came to me. It wasn't so much I found them. And it's all about, you know, you don't do, this is before Google, you know, and before computers. You would, if I had to interview somebody, I would find out what I could about them. Particularly people in the government, because how boring is it for somebody, you know, who's a cabinet level position, have reporters come in and ask stupid questions, which they do. So I always learned to start at the, just be different. And do more work. And that's, you know, it's not hard.
When you were working in Washington, which in many ways was a fraught period, there were early episodes that opened your eyes to the fact that people will lie bald-faced.
One of the things that happened with the Pentagon, it was very hard to report on the Vietnam War because you had to sign in at every office you went to. So if you got something really good from somebody, you had to spend 2 days talking to other generals.
And just to muddy the waters.
Make it harder for them. If there were more than 5 or 6 people, they wouldn't search you out. And so Harrison Salisbury of the New York Times had gone to Hanoi, the first reporter allowed in years, in 1966, and over Christmas of 65, 66. And he was filing dispatches to the Times that talked about bombing that we didn't know anything about. Bombing the hell out of the North. And a lot of bombs missing their target. I was writing propaganda as the AP correspondent. And over Christmas, there was a little...
You were writing propaganda?
Well, of course. I was getting the briefings.
Did you know you were writing propaganda?
I don't know what you think Pentagon correspondents do for a living. But I will tell you that inevitably, if you're covering a beat and it involves the Pentagon or the CIA, you're writing propaganda today.
Mm-hmm.
I was very bitter about this, and I did break and write a few different stories that basically got me fired by the AP. But
mm-hmm.
they got me transferred to some Health and Human Services, in which they knew I'd quit. But anyway, I wrote some very aggressive stuff. And over Christmas, there was a cocktail party for the press, and everybody's being nice, and McNamara had been lying about bombing. I'd gotten to some admirals and generals who were telling me the truth. And so I broke the rules. I said, tell me about the bombing, Mr. Secretary. He had worked on the study of the bombing after World War II, a special commission. He was an officer. He wrote papers that talked about how bad the bombing was. And he laughed and he said, yes, it's true. Bombings never go where they go. And everybody laughed and I was enraged.
This was at a cocktail party.
Well, I was off the record. So I wrote a piece about it under a pseudonym for them, for a very gutsy weekly, the National Catholic Reporter, that was a brilliant paper. I broke every rule in the book. I wrote a piece about McNamara with his arrogance. And they put it all over page one and a fake name, I think. You know, I was a marked man, and deservedly so. I broke the rules.
You wrote that when Robert McNamara's senior press aide retired in 1967, we're talking about a guy who spent 6 years yelling and screaming at any reporter who got out of line, a guy named Arthur
Sylvester.
Right. He wrote this, it's on page 62. For 6 years, I watched cover stories promulgated by his own office go down as smooth as cream when I thought they would cause a frightful gargle. In other words, he had contempt for the press corps for swallowing the garbage that he was dishing out day by day.
It's an amazing clip, you know. One of the things about doing a memoir is you think your memory is good, and the first thing you learn is it's terrible. That was an essay in Saturday Evening Post or something.
It's a devastating indictment.
That's what I thought. But the coverage of the war from Washington was awful. It was terrible. When I got hired by the New York Times, it was by Abe Rosenthal, with whom I tangled so much.
Oh, my God. The stories in the book about that relationship.
Oh, my.
You had legendary scoops at the time about CIA surveillance, about Watergate. You always got space on the front page, well, almost every time. And there's an incredible story about you waking up the Times managing editor, Abe Rosenthal, in the wee small hours under very awkward circumstances.
You know, despite my fighting with Abe, and it was constant, he did trust me.
More than you trusted him, I think.
Well, I thought his motive in deciding we've got to go after Watergate was he wanted to show Ben Bradley that he could do it, too.
Well, that's okay. It was his entrenchment with the powers that be.
It just was a connection with the Times, that's all. And I was the oddball out there, clearly. So they hired me to go to Washington and do stuff on the war. And I learned in early 1972 there was some horrible secret inside the CIA involving criminal activity in America. There was a subsequent study done by the CIA itself, all full of stuff about how they were watching me for 2 years. I hadn't told anybody about the domestic spying story. I knew there was something there. It took a long time. Finally, December the 20th, 1974, I see the head of the CIA, William Colby, in his office about 9:30 in the morning, and I say, okay. By then, I knew they'd been on my case, watching me. And I said, here's what I know. You wiretapped this guy, and you did this, and you did all these operations domestically. And what Colby did is he never said no. He would say, no, we didn't do 150 wiretaps of reporters. We only did about 30. So he minimized everything. And I think he thought that was okay. But I walked out of there for the first time. I knew he was in trouble, and I could do this story. And this is a story, actually, about a reporter and an editor. I called Abe up from a payphone on Route 123 outside of the CIA and said, I've got this amazing story I've been doing. Let me tell you about it. The CIA has been spying on American citizens. He said, what? I said, yeah. He said, well, go write it. And so I went to the office and I started writing. Abe had told the Sunday editor, a guy named Ev Jenkins, Hearst is going to have a story. So they saved 2,500 words, I guess. About 2 o'clock or 2:30 in the morning, I'm in the office. I'm alone. I love being alone at night in the big newsroom.
And you were about at word 7,000.
I was at word 5, but it was going to go that much. It was going to be a whole page. The guy making up the Sunday paper, Jenkins, says, what are you doing, Si? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you've written 4,000 or 5,000 words. Abe told me about 2 or 3 columns. The paper's all made up. We know you're doing a story. We've got space on page 1. Maybe I can get another 500 words for you. I said, what? Are you reading the story? Yeah, he said, it's dynamite, but what can I do? I said, okay, hang up. I don't socialize with editors. I just don't, never did, and I don't like to. I mean, they're nice people, but, you know, I'd rather have a rabbit as a friend. Anyway, in the editor's desk, I found the home phone number for Abe, and I call it up. And it rings about 7-8 times.
Because this is 2:30 in the morning.
Yeah. So what? Somebody wrote a review, and he said, he's so self-obsessed. Are you kidding? I've got a story about domestic spying.
So I'm just saying that's why it rang so long.
And so, at the time, his wife's name was Ann. I'd met her once. I said, Ann, just blah, 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 blah. I got to wake him up. She said, what? I said, Ann, I got to wake him up. She said, well, go find the unpleasant words he said about the woman he's sleeping with and hung up. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, I'm in the middle of a soap opera. But I thought about it for a second. I said, look, she was, you know, she'd been with this guy for 25 years. I called back, and she answered in the third, what, she said. I said, tell me who the lady is. I got to find Abe. It's about a story that you'll be glad you helped. Long silence, and she gave me the name. It was somebody who was in public life who was enlisted. I then had to call one of my agents up and get them to get an unlisted phone number, and I then called her.
So now it's about 3 in the morning.
Yeah, well,
I can't believe you called back Ann Rosenthal.
I called back. And I said, you've been a reporter's wife for 25 years. You know the business. I need him. There's a story that's important about wrongdoing by the government, and I know you'd want the story to be published. And so she helped me. And so I found this person, and I called him. I had one of those cutoffs after 5 rings.
Mm-hmm.
Called again, and finally she answered. And I said, look, lady, just wake him up. I beg your pardon. I said, just tell him Cy Hirsch is on the phone, and I'm going to go blow up the f***ing news. A minute later, he says, are you crazy? I go, blah, 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 blah. And he says, hang up. I'll call you back in 5 minutes. I hung up. I'm running around, pacing, jumping up. And 5 minutes later, he calls and he says, okay, whatever he called me, numbskull or whatever it was, here's what's going to happen. 1.6 million editions of the New York Times tomorrow are going to have a house set on one side and your cockamamie, I remember that word, story on the other side. Is that okay? You happy? I said, yes, now. If you ever tell anything about what happened tonight, he said, I will come and beat the hell, whatever he said. And I waited till he died. He'd been dead for 10 years and wrote it. I thought, what the hell? But here's what's important. It's a 7,000-word story burying the CIA, more, 7,500 words. Stayed writing until about 7, kind of 12. They had an edit. There was concern about the word, I used the word massive, and we agreed that there was 100,000 files I knew about. That's massive on American citizens. The sourcing was A+. I did deal with people at the top. And by the way, I called many that day about this story. Nobody said, of course, we're talking off the record or on background. I was only writing stories about bad stuff. I didn't write stories about good operations they did. The people knew that. Anyway, the New York Times ran a story burying the CIA, led to the church hearing, led to the first formal investigation, led to the establishment of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, which has been ruined now by partisanship, mm-hmm. but led to incredibly good change. They ran that story, and it was a sole matter of trust between Abe Rosenthal and me. I did that story, and he didn't know about it for 2 days in advance, even though the CIA had known about it for 2 years. I do write about this in the book. And it didn't matter. The trust was there.
Let's talk about when and how that happens, because what I gathered from your book is that it was much easier to expose the wrongdoing of public institutions than of powerful people who are close to reporters. And Bill Kovich, a colleague of yours in 73 who went on to become the Washington bureau chief, explained years later to the Washington Post that one of the biggest problems he had as an editor was, quote, managing Cy at a newspaper that hated to be beaten but didn't really want to be first. So you got this CIA surveillance story out, but evidently, frequently, it played out differently.
Yes. Well, later it did at the New York Times. What happened is later I picked up a freelance writer named Jeff Girth, who was a wonderful journalist who had a great career at the Times. I was doing stuff on organized crime. I was living in New York then, and I went after a big corporation, mm-hmm. Gulf and Western, run by a guy named Charlie Bluedorn, who was a very good friend, apparently, of the publisher. He owned Paramount Movies, and he used to show movies in advance to all the editors, all the powerful people in town. He had a and it was horrible. The New York Times just did not want to take on big business. They were squeezed by me. To their credit, they ran four stories that I and Jeff did on page one about Gulf and Weston. But
the editing, they were denuded of all style, of all anonymous quotes.
It was the worst experience I had. And this is what I was interested in. It was 79. We were at peace. I did leave the paper. The hardest reporting in the world is to do a corporation, because it turned out later, as I did this book, during the research, the New York Public Library has all of Rosenthal's papers. And there was all these letters that Gulf and Weston had written about me and what I and Girth were doing and saying.
Worked very hard to discredit you.
But they never shared them to me.
Yeah.
The editors never gave me a chance to answer that. They just, I don't know what they believed or didn't believe. And I left and went on to write books. But it was a terrible time. It was a year of purgatory. The stories were so beaten down, they were incomprehensible, I thought.
You know, it's funny, despite all the Sturm und Drang you went through in Washington, even before you got to New York, you told Bob Thompson of the Washington Post that those years in Washington, there'll never be a period like that in our business again. Nobody can understand what it was like. Boy, wake up. Boy, hear story. Boy, get story. Boy, put story in paper. No trauma.
I said something else I decided not to put in the book.
What was that?
It was over at Gulf and Western or even the Korshak. I did a series of a gangster called Korshak. Boy, wake up. Boy, get story. Boy, get edited. Boy, get tortured. Boy, throw typewriter through window. Boy, go home. Boy, come back. Window fixed. Typewriter back in his desk. Nobody says anything.
And that's true.
It was awful.
Except Abe Rosenthal brought you a letter saying, unlike you and me, some people are civilized.
What happened was I went screaming about the second guessing going on about an organized crime series. It was just ridiculous. I said, you guys are all nuts. You're all just running around trying to prove to Abe Rosenthal you can edit Hirsch and you can show Hirsch how to be better. That's just crazy and stop it. So Abe then writes me a note and saying, instead of complaining, I would be enormously grateful. He then said, unlike you and me, most of the editors here are civilized and polite. I just couldn't help but laugh.
There are many lessons here for journalists or would-be journalists. The Hirsch rule about never asking a core question at the beginning. But there was something I found really illuminating when you were describing what you called the Wicker moment, and then the moment that you had that revealed the character of powerful people.
Well, Tom Wicker was this wonderful, wonderful journalist who, by 1964, long before I got to the paper, was made the editor in Washington. And he also had a column. And in 73 or 74, I was pounding away like everybody else. And so I received the transcript. At that time, Nixon transcripts were not made public, but it must have been 74. They were using the White House taping system. Once the government learned about it, they used it to prosecute people. I got a transcript of Nixon just on a rage and using every vile term he could for minorities, Italians and Polish people and Jewish people in particular, a lot of very horrible stuff. So we told the White House in advance we were going to write this story about using terms like spick and kike. There was a lot of angst about it. Mm-hmm. The White House, the press apparatus, there was a lot of attacks on me and the Times. And the whole context of what he did raises serious questions about this president's, who in the hell is he? What kind of a person is mm-hmm. he to talk this way in private? And so while this was going on, it was back and forth, Tom Wicker, who was then this the columnist. And remember, when I was at the Times, Tony Lewis was a columnist. So you had Russell Baker using fey, sardonic language to make wonderful points. Mm-hmm. Instead of this constant drumbeat we have, Trump's so dumb. But we had Tom Wicker writing great columns. Anyway, mm-hmm. he slid up next to me and he said, I want to tell you a story that's been tormenting me.
This is Tom Wicker.
And he said in 65, when Johnson began to expand the war in Vietnam, every Friday they were, in the summer, they'd fly down to the ranch, you know, in Texas, this huge ranch that he had. Covering Johnson was always sort of a wild trip. And one Friday before he left, he filed a story raising a lot of questions about the war. the conduct of the war. In those days, the Times, with all the money it had, it would fly the Saturday newspaper down to the ranch. And so in the morning, everybody saw the story, and Tom's column was fronted. It was on page one. It was an analysis piece.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a morning briefing they had around 10:30. George Reedy was the press secretary then, I think. He was saying to everybody that the lid is on, which meant go play some golf or go play tennis.
No news will be made today.
No news. Johnson had a white Cadillac convertible. And all of a sudden, here comes the Lincoln convertible at high speed, blowing dirt all over on a dirt road, slams on the brakes right in front of the press group, opens the passenger door, calls out Wicker. And Wicker looks at him and he crooks his finger. So Wicker walks and he gets into the car. Johnson says nothing. They drive off for, 50, 60 miles an hour. And he stops by some bushes and puts on the emergency brake, walks behind some bushes and bends down and defecates. Tom can see this, wipes himself with leaves, comes back, gets in the car, turns around, doesn't say a word, speeds like hell back to where the press is still there, sort of wondering what's going on, stops, leans over, open the door, give a little motion, get out. Tom said, here's why I'm talking to you. I knew then, in this visceral way, that the war was going to continue no matter what, and that he was going to kill a lot more people, that he was crazy when it came to that war. And he said, I didn't know whether to tell that story or not, and I never did. So I'm glad you wrote the story about what Nixon said about Jews and Italians, WAPs, and Kikes and Polacks. I'm glad you did that. That was his message. We already were building up the war. We had 300,000 people, but the real casualties didn't come. There were 2,000 a week and by 67, 68. In 68, there were some months where he had 10,000 a month killed. But the underlying message to me that left me chilled was he knew something then, viscerally, that must have haunted him.
Well, you see, that's just it. Nixon, in employing that language, his office said, oh, well, it was affectionate, it was a joke, but it was crazy. And what Johnson did was crazy.
Yes.
And let's talk about Trump just briefly. A great deal of ink has been spilled over his administration's treatment of the media, specifically the lies, and whether the press does enough to push back. Do we see an endless stream of Wicker moments, or is this something else?
One thing you can say is, what you see is what you got. You're not going to find private tapes in which he says something differently.
Mm-hmm.
My worry about what's going on is I watched the polls. He's gone up maybe 7-8 points. That's 20%. Since the beating up got more intense.
The press beating up on him.
And I don't know if he's maybe smarter than we think. He's controlling the agenda totally. Totally. He attacks now and the FBI is out to get me. Whatever it is, it just doesn't end the coverage. I mean, I look at the cable news and I just think, oh, have we really come to this? That if I'm in the New York Times, I get a tip on a story, a tip becomes a story, and then I put it online for the Times, and then I go on, MSNBC that night to talk about it. I can't relate to what's going on. A lot of tips and a lot of secondhand stuff is being run as serious stories, even in the good newspapers. And that's the meaning. If Putin says, I want to see you, he may go see Putin. What are you going to do, attack him on that forever? What if he takes out 28,000 troops from South Korea? We have that many, or 26,000. And saves us a couple of $1 billion a year. Is that bad? He may be a circuit breaker. I'm just saying, pick your fights, that's all. Giuliani ranting and raving should be ignored. I wouldn't pay much attention to that. I wouldn't pay much attention to the Daily. I would go all over every cabinet member. The Times and Post are doing Pruitt. I would do them all. I would do over decisions made. I would do over how things work. A daily story about some child taken away from his mother on the Mexican border. I would just do that. It's so friggin' insane. I would talk to experts who would tell you how horrible that's going to be. You're creating monsters when you do that. Damage that's just incomprehensible. Okay, you got my lecture. More than you want. Goodbye, I got to go.
Okay, bye. Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
After 90 minutes, he ran away. Seymour Hersh is the author of Reporter, a memoir.